One day, at a Starbucks in Southern California, an expert in the Bible stood up to test Jesus. "Teacher," he asked, while sipping his Americano, "what must I do to inherit eternal life?" "What is written in the law," Jesus replied. "How do you read it?" He answered, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself." "You have answered correctly," Jesus replied. "Do this and you will live." But he wanted to justify himself, so he asked Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" In reply, Jesus said, "A man was driving from San Diego to Los Angeles when he was carjacked by robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. A Christian pastor from a mega church in San Bernardino happened to be going down the interstate, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. A little while later, a famous theologian from a seminary in La Mirada was driving by when he came to the place and saw him, but he was late for class, and so he passed by on the other side. A short while after, this famous atheist was on his way to a skeptics convention at UCLA, and he drove along in his Toyota Prius, it's one with a Darwin fish sticker on the bumper. He came to where the man was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him. He pulled onto the shoulder of the road, went out, and administered first aid. Then he put the man in the back seat of the Prius and brought him to a local hospital. The hospital demanded to see the man's health insurance. "I don't know that he has any," said the atheist. So he pulled out his credit card. "Look after him," he said, "and you can charge any necessary expenses on my card." Which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of robbers? The expert in the Bible replied, "The one who had mercy on him." Jesus told him, "Go and do likewise." And he writes, "Do you possibly find a good Samaritan if you look really hard?" You might find a good Samaritan if you looked really hard, but a good atheist? Randall Rouser is a professor of historical theology at Taylor Seminary in Edmonton, Alberta. He is the author of many books, including The Swedish Atheist, The Scuba Diver, and other apologetic rabbit tales, and You're Not as Crazy as I Think, Dialogue in a World of Loud Voices and Hardened Opinions. He blogs and podcasts as the Tentative Apologist at RandallRouser.com. He was a guest on our program on November 3rd, 2003, and that's what I was referring to when I mistakenly started to say that his latest book is What on Earth Do We Know About Heaven? 20 Questions and Answers About Life After Death. You may remember that program. It was very interesting. Professor, welcome back to Amplify.
Great to be with you, Father Ron. Thanks.
Tell us a little bit about why you dedicate this book for all those who ever hoped God exists, and also what prompted you to write this book.
Yeah, so that's an interesting place to begin. That is the dedication. It's dedicated to those who hope God exists, and that's actually one of the themes, I think, that sort of emerged in the book. We often think of the atheist, growing up in the church, I thought of the atheist as someone threatening, as an outsider, you know, as an apostate, as someone subversive, someone challenging God. So a lot of negative associations. But at the core of atheism is doubt in the existence of God. And when you put it in those terms, you realize doubt is also something that Christians experience. And in that sense, we're share something with atheists. We often find ourselves doubting the goodness, the care of God, even sometimes the existence of God. Doubts like that often characterize the Christian faith. And in that sense, I've come to recognize an affinity with atheists, that we can all be in that place of questioning. Along with that, then, is another thing that I've learned is I used to think that atheists were all sort of in this angry rebellion against God, getting to know some atheists very well, they share with me their deep desire that God would exist. They still find themselves doubting. They find themselves without belief, but they would like there to be a God. They hope there is a God. They don't seem to be in rebellion against God. So this book, in that sense, is dedicated to all those people, whether they call themselves atheists or whether they call themselves Christians, who find themselves sometimes struggling to believe there is a God and yet hoping and wanting to believe there is a God.
Now, as a matter of fact, any of us probably could have could rewrite the parable of the Good Samaritan. The Samaritans, of course, were the great enemies of the Jews at that time. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. But we could replace Good Samaritan with almost any individual or any group of people, couldn't we?
Yeah, we could. I think too often we fail to, and that's where we lose something of the power of Jesus' parables and the way they spoke in their day. Today, when we hear the phrase Good Samaritan, it doesn't strike us as offensive or unusual. In fact, that makes sense. We want to be a Good Samaritan. We want to be the kind of person who helps others. The associations with the term are completely positive, but of course that wasn't the case 2,000 years ago, and we really need to get back and consider just how subversive some of Jesus' teachings on who our neighbor is. We need to consider how subversive those teachings really are.
And then what it really means to be a Christian, what we're really challenged to be.
Exactly right. Yeah, and as it's been said, the church is the only institution that exists for the sake of its non-members. That mm-hmm. The church is a healthy church insofar that it's a church reaching out to the world rather than a church building walls against the world.
And of course, not everyone would reach out to an atheist, and they haven't in the past. Tell us about what you call the rebellion thesis, the primary source of hostility for at least Christians towards atheists. We'll talk about that in the past, a kind of a brief survey to bring us up to date.
Yeah, so this idea that I call the rebellion thesis is a central idea in the book that I want to criticize. And the rebellion thesis is my attempt to put in a succinct, short form, common attitudes that Christians have toward atheists. And basically the idea is that while atheists claim that they don't believe in God, the disbelief that they have is the result of them actively suppressing God's natural revelation to them. That they don't want to recognize God is there, and so they're suppressing that revelation, and they're doing that because they really hate God, because they're angry at God and hostile toward him. So this assumption is then that if every time you meet somebody who's an atheist, the only reason they're an atheist, the only reason they don't believe there's a God is because at some level they are angry at God, they are hostile toward him, and they don't want to submit to him.
Your thesis, you just described it, you defined it in the book, while atheists profess to believe that God does not exist, this belief is the result of an active and culpable suppression of an innate disposition to believe in God, which is born of a hatred of God and a desire to sin with impunity. And you begin your book talking about Pastor John Hagee, and you think perhaps that he may reflect the beliefs and feelings of many Christians.
Yes, I mean, I'll say this too, that I'm a Protestant, and so most of the examples I give are from Protestant and evangelical traditions, but I also make note that in the Catholic tradition you have some similar attitudes. But I begin with Pastor Hagee, and there's a good reason for that, because he's not a fringe figure. He's has one of the largest churches in the U.S. in Texas. It's over 20,000 people weekly. He regularly appears as a pundit speaking on religious matters on channels like CNN, and he's had books on the bestseller list in the New York Times. And he's said things like, atheism is bankrupt and empty, it's brain dead. He's told atheists, if you don't like it in America, then move, get out. And when he says these things, and you can actually see these clips of him saying these things on YouTube, he's saying these things from the pulpit, and he's getting raucous applause coming from the pews. So it seems to me like there's a lot of hostility that he reflects, which is more reflective of these mainstream Christian attitudes toward atheists, which are very hostile.
And we won't go into it, but you talk about a film also, God's Not Dead. I'm not familiar with it, but it depicts atheists in those same ways. And an example of a German atheist shoe company that a lot of the shoes didn't get delivered because they saw the term atheist on the box. And they were able to prove that in a way through an experiment of sending out different boxes. We're going to take a break. At this time, Professor, and then we come back. We're going to continue our discussion with Professor Randall Rouser. While is the Atheist My Neighbor? Rethinking Christian Attitudes Toward Atheism. Welcome back to the second part of the first of 2 hours of Amplify. We had a phone call from someone who has identified himself as an atheist. I asked him if he would please call back during the second hour when we'll take phone calls. I really want to try to establish professor, and that's, let me introduce him again, Professor Randall Rouser, who is the, a book titled, Is the Atheist My Neighbor? He's a professor of historical theology at Taylor Seminary in Edmonton, Alberta. And as we were speaking during the first part, we had talked about a little bit about what he calls the rebellion thesis, which he believes is the primary source of hostility for at least Christians toward atheists, which states in summary that atheists seek to block out the voice of God they hate. And I should tell you right now, that's not what Professor believes. He really wants to disprove that. But then he goes through five voices, and he says they don't speak for all Christians in their respective time periods. Nonetheless, each was an influential and highly esteemed Christian leader of his day, a philosopher, a scientist, an essayist, a theologian, and a pastor. What is perhaps most telling is that each states his views on atheism matter-of-factly, with no sense of straying far from popular opinion or courting controversy. In conclusion, he writes, the brief survey provides solid evidence that prior to the 20th century, the rebellion thesis was widely embraced. Professor, tell us a little bit more about one or more of these people who you believe embrace the rebellion thesis so we can move on to today.
Sure. So I go back about 300 years in a very quick survey. As you mentioned, I take a look at five significant people. I wanted to take a look at people who were leaders in their fields and, as you say, who expressed their views toward atheism in a matter-of-fact way, because if you're not feeling the need to defend it, if you just sort of state it, then that's indicative that these were common opinions. And so perhaps the most unsettling example, I would say, comes from Charles Spurgeon. He was a 19th century Protestant pastor, preacher in London, England. He was one of the most popular preachers of the latter half of the 19th century, so very influential. And he published a large three-volume Treasury of David. It's like a commentary on the Psalms. And when it comes to Psalm 14:1, that's a verse that's often used against atheists. It says, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. And people interpret that often to mean that that's referring to atheists and that atheists are fools. And that's the interpretation that Charles Spurgeon gives. And then he goes on and he says that atheism is actually worse than the demons of hell, because even the demons at least know that God exists, but the atheists deny that God exists. And Spurgeon, then he quotes from a famous person named Joseph Addison, who was a hymn writer and an essayist from the 18th century. And Joseph Addison recalls having been on a boat with a person that they found out was an atheist. And the sailors on the boat were thinking they should toss him overboard, but unfortunately, they had already gotten too close to shore. And you're just reading this, and you're thinking, wow, this is a pretty incredibly hostile attitude toward atheists. And then Addison goes on, and he refers to atheists as vermin and a creature. Mm-hmm. And all of this, you're reading this within a commentary on the Psalms. So it shows the degree of hostility that many Christians have had toward atheists when they're treated as vermin, when they're described as someone you might want to drown if you had the opportunity. And these reflect some quite common attitudes, in my experience, coming up to the 20th century.
Robert Boyle, you write, believe that he was a scientist, that atheists have no interest in pursuing or knowing the truth, and that their atheism was a result of their active will to suppress their conscience, born of the desire not to be accountable to anybody for the lives they live. In short, he views the atheists in the mold of Herod Antipas, who cynically retorted, "What is truth?" In the same manner, the atheist shows no genuine interest in really knowing the way things are. And you believe that the principles of Spurgeon and Boyle are absurd, don't you? And you reject them.
Yeah, of course there could be atheists who are angry at God or have an axe to grind against God. I think there are many Christians who are angry at God. But to assume that every person who professes not to believe in God, that they are all angry against God, that they are all hostile toward God, I think it's not borne out either by a close reading of the Bible or by personal experience. If you actually get out and get to know people who are atheists, I think you find just a wide variety of opinions and a wide variety of dispositions. And we just can't broad brush all people in this way.
And you write that the practice of dehumanizing outgroups by labeling them as creatures, vermin, or some other form of pestilence has been a common feature of genocides throughout history. Say a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so what I'm pointing out there is sort of genocide, which is the targeting of a particular group for extermination based upon their cultural, ethnic, or religious identity. And so something like Rwanda, the mass killing of people, is the most extreme case of genocide. But the point I'm making there is, I mean, genocide is just the most extreme example of marginalizing a group where you actually try to eliminate them. And I don't think there's been any genocide of atheists, but I think we need to recognize that the kind of language that we use when we dehumanize people, whether they be atheists or anyone else, when we call them vermin, as Joseph Addison did, that is deeply dehumanizing language. And that is the kind of language that people do use to justify extreme acts of oppression and violence like genocide. So it's something we really need to be careful about.
Let's move then to some of the contemporary attitudes toward atheism. It's your belief that negative views have diversified and have softened a little bit, but that some contemporary conservative evangelicals, and as you said, you're a Protestant, so you're writing it from that perspective, but it would include Catholics also, still adhere to the old views. Atheists are either fools or liars, Psalm 14, verse 1, that no reasonable and moral person could deny the existence of God. Tell us about some of the more modern views, D. James Kennedy and R.C. Sproul, for example.
Yeah, so, well, R.C. Sproul is certainly a vivid example. Now, he's a Christian, a conservative Reformed Christian apologist and theologian. He's been very popular for the last 40 years or so, written many books. In one of his books, he recalls being on a university campus, being invited to an atheist group to speak on the existence of God, so to give his arguments for God's existence. And he recounts that he argued for maybe an hour or so, giving his lecture on why he believes God exists. But then he says this. He says, "I'm giving you arguments for the existence of God, but I feel like I'm carrying coals to Newcastle because I have to tell you that I do not have to prove to you that God exists because I think you know it already. Your problem is not that you do not know God exists. Your problem is that you despise the God whom you know exists. Your problem is not intellectual, it is moral. You hate God."
Right.
That's what this famous theologian, R.C. Sproul, says to this group of atheists who invited him to speak. He says, he reprimands them, he harangues them, he says, "You hate God." That has to be one of the most striking and I think unsettling modern examples of the rebellion thesis I've come across. And I have to say that just from a pastoral perspective, that would be devastating for any subsequent Christian trying to reach out to that community, because now they're going to be thinking of all Christians like R.C. Sproul as people who angrily judge them without even knowing them.
But even more so, you raise the question, how would Christians feel if their religion was described as a religion of fools or a religion of hatred?
Yes, yeah, so it comes back really to the golden rule. So do we extend to other people the same charity and grace that we would like extended to us? If we, and you know, I have to say here that people often, Christians have often focused on the new atheists, people like Richard Dawkins, who have gotten a lot of attention dismissing Christianity and other religious traditions as just foolish, ignorant, dangerous. Well, in a sense, Christians are getting a little bit of their own medicine for a lot of the ways that they've angrily marginalized the atheist community. Now some people in the atheist community are sort of returning fire, and that's what you're seeing. In fact, in the geopolitics, the CIA calls this blowback, this idea that if you invade a country, if you show hostility toward a country, they react aggressively in return, and it's called blowback. And I think Christians have experienced some blowback.
And the simple lesson you point out is that one cannot draw any divide between atheists and Christians based on their respective attitudes to either determinism or free will. And as Jesus instructed, we ought to do to others as we would like others to do to us. So if Christians are offended when atheists caricature their views, then Christians should be vigilant about not replying in kind. And that's because they're Christians. Is that what you're arguing?
Yeah, exactly right. I think that, again, if we felt the sting of marginalization from somebody like Richard Dawkins calling us a faith head and saying we're irrational, well, we now have a better sense of how many atheists have felt when they've been shut out from Christian communities. I've spoken with many atheists over the years who have gone through a real dark night of the soul, sharing their doubts with people in the Christian community and getting shot down, getting a sense of fear, of alienation, almost a sort of shunning. And once they get cut off from that community, it's no surprise that they've got some anger and hostility.
And you believe that flippant caricaturing of atheism remains distressingly common among Christian leaders today?
Yes, I still think that these attitudes are quite common. So, I mean, I selected a few well-known examples, but as you noted, some of those other examples, like that film God is Dead, which came out last year. Now, that was a film. It was produced by a Christian film company, and it was only made for a $2 or $3 million. It had a low budget, but it went on to gross over $60 million at the box office. It was a huge, hugely popular movie. In fact, they're making a sequel for it now. And in that film, it depicts an atheist philosophy professor at a university who, on the first day of class, has all his students write "there is no" or "God is dead" on a piece of paper. And the one Christian student refuses, and so then the atheist philosophy professor starts persecuting that student, and he tells that student in the hallway, "I am God," and he's very angry and hostile. And that is just the kind of picture, again, at a popular level that people have of atheists. But, we don't like it when Hollywood depicts us, Christians, in very negative stereotype terms, so we shouldn't do the same to other groups.
You write, like two roads diverging in the wood, John Hagee and Pope Francis represent two very different approaches to Christian engagement with the atheist community. One road dismisses atheists as brain dead and tells them to get out of the country. The other road embraces them with kindness as true neighbors. I believe it's time for Christians to repent of their prejudices and take the road less traveled. The atheist is our neighbor, and this book explains why. Tell us a little bit the difference in Pope Francis's approach.
I have, like many people, I mean, I think I have to line up to express how I have just found Pope Francis and his demeanor, his interactions with people, to be just such a breath of fresh air for Christians everywhere. And the way that he's led the way in atheist has, I think, been very inspirational. He developed a close, I think, friendship with Jose Mujica, the president of Uruguay, who is an avowed atheist. And they met together and developed this nice, close relationship. And afterwards, Mujica referred to him as a friendly neighbor. And just think about that, an atheist head of state meeting with the vicar of Christ, with the head of the Roman Catholic Church, and coming away saying the Pope was a friendly neighbor. I think that is a witness to all of us that we need to learn how to extend hospitality toward other people, because we're never going to draw anybody to the cross with a closed fist. We draw them with an open hand. And the hospitality that Pope Francis has shown, I think, is a challenge to us all. And it just contrasts so starkly with that pulpit-thumping anger and alienation that you get from some Christian leaders like John Hagee.
Let's go back to the Bible. You've already spoke to it briefly. Does the Bible say that atheists are fools? You know, why is context so critical to understanding what Psalms 14:1 means?
Yes, so that's, as I said, that's a passage that is often proof-texted. Now, that term proof-texting happens when it refers to the behavior of taking a text out of the context in which it is and just sort of using it for your own purposes. So we say the fool is that in his heart there is no God, and therefore atheists are fools. Well, that does violence to the text for at least a couple reasons. The first reason is we're reading back into that text a much later understanding of atheism. So atheism, in the modern sense of denying that any God exists, is really a phenomena that emerges in the 1700s, perhaps in the 1600s. But it certainly didn't exist long, 2 millennia before the Enlightenment, when the Psalms were written. Back in the ancient world, 500, 600, 700 years before the time of Christ, everybody was some kind of theist. So in Psalm 14:1, what's being talked about is not the cognitive atheist, the person who denies God exists. Rather, it's the person who doesn't live in accord with God's law. The person who says in his heart there is no God, the person, in other words, who doesn't follow God, follow what he requires. This becomes clear as we read into verses 2 and 3, where it says, all have sinned and all have fallen short. So the message of Psalm 14 is that everybody falls under the indictment of God because we all fail to act and live as we should. It is not an indictment of atheists. And when we use it in that way, we really do violence to the text, and we totally miss the condemnation that it gives to us for our own hypocrisy.
And you're right, given the fact that Psalm 14:1 is so commonly used as an indictment of atheists, it is surely ironic to observe that it is in fact an indictment of devotees of Yahweh who fail to live up to their professed belief. How ironic it is that a text that was intended to warn against religious hypocrisy is instead proof text as a rhetorical bludgeon against atheists who make no such faith confession in the first place. And then you raise the question, and just who is the fool exactly? That raises us to some thinking, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's maybe stated in a little bit of a stark manner, but I think sometimes we just need to get shaken out of the way that we're reading texts, because the way that we often read text, it's human nature, is to read them in accord with our interests, to vindicate ourselves. And of course, Jesus warns about this in the very provocative parable of a man wanting to pick out the sliver in his neighbor's eye while having a plank sticking out of his own head. If that looks absurd, and it should, that nonetheless describes the situation of so many of us on a regular basis when we miss our own planks in our head and go for the slivers in others.
And while we're referring to Scripture, tell us what we can learn from Ephesians 2:12 and why Romans 1:18 is important in this discussion.
In Ephesians 2:12, we have a reference to the term that would become atheist, atheos in Greek, an adjective, which refers to being without God. The thing is that what is going on in Ephesians 2:12 is it reflects a common charge that Christians or different peoples would be charged with being without God simply because they denied the gods of other people. So in the ancient world, the word atheist or atheos, it reflected simply the idea of denying the God that a person believes in. And so this just showed that this wasn't the modern conception of atheism is different from the ancient conception. Let me give you an example. So Polycarp was a bishop of Smyrna who was martyred in about the year 155. And it was because, he was told before he was going to be killed, you need to renounce the atheists. And by atheists, they meant the Christians, because the Christians denied the Roman gods. Instead, he says, okay, away with the atheists, but he meant the Romans, because they were denying the Christian God. So both sides were calling the others atheist or atheos, because the other was denying their God. And so that just shows that we have to be careful about reading a later understanding of atheist.
All right, Professor, let me break in there. We need to take this break now. If you can just hang up, we'll call you back, and then we'll continue our discussion of your book, Is the Atheist My Neighbor? Rethinking Attitudes About Atheism. And you just think that thesis, the rebellion thesis, is simply intolerable. Welcome back to the second hour of Amplify. Let me reset the program. Randall Rouser is the professor of historical theology at Taylor Seminary in Edmonton, Alberta. We're talking about his book, Is the Atheist My Neighbor? Rethinking Christian Attitudes Toward Atheism, as we began the program. We read a rewriting on his part of the parable of the Good Samaritan, and we have been exploring what he believes was kind of the thesis, rebellion thesis behind the way in which people have viewed for centuries atheists. The rebellion thesis states, while atheists profess to believe that God does not exist, this belief is the result of an active and culpable suppression of an innate disposition to believe in God, which is born of a hatred of God and a desire to sin with impunity. And after finally reaching a point where scripture is examined, he concludes, it seems to me that the implications of the rebellion thesis are simply intolerable. The Christian cannot deny the fact that God's existence and nature are not always plain and clear. The fact is that there are countless people of religious faith who have not always found God's existence and nature to be plain and clear. And one example that he uses is of Mother Teresa, how a few years after she passed, her journals were published and revealed a soul that was tortured and had many doubts and questions. And she admitted that, to the point of even questioning whether God existed or whether Jesus was a savior. And Professor points out that she's not alone. Countless Christians can resonate deeply with this honest account of struggle. And it reminds us once again that doubt is indeed a standard part of the Christian life. And the fact is that God's existence and nature do not always appear plain and clear, even to very saintly people. We're going to open our phone lines now. If you've wanted to call before and get in and discuss this topic, please do now. Toll free 866-391-1020. That's 866-391-1020. So we've concluded indeed the Bible does not say that atheists are fools. Professor, you then raise the question about atheists and what they really believe. And perhaps one of the most enlightening parts of it for me was when you had an interview within the book with John Lowder. Say a little bit about that interview, on what it means to him. Or Jeff, I said John. Jeff, how does he explain his atheistic views and why he holds them?
Jeff Lowder is he's a very well-known atheist online. 20 years ago, he started this group called Internet Infidels, and he's been working online promoting atheism for the last 20 years. But the interesting thing, first of all, when you talk with Jeff or interact with him, is you find he's not hostile toward God. In fact, he quite explicitly says he hopes God exists. But he's simply not persuaded that God exists as he evaluates the evidence. And so in that interview I have with Jeff, I let him just lay out his case. And he largely argues on the basis of naturalism. Naturalism basically being the idea that nature is all that exists. He argues that that is a simpler and more intellectually satisfactory view than theism. And he gives his case for that, but he's also open to being persuaded otherwise. And I thought what was interesting about interacting with Jeff is that too often we just want to give a quick rebuttal, right? We just want to, when people offer a view different than ours, like Jeff's view of naturalism and atheism, we want to just sort of give all the answers to answer their objections. But there is a place for simply allowing people to speak and sharing their view and really coming to understand it. And I think that, again, comes back to this idea of hospitality or of the golden rule, that if we were interacting with an atheist and everything that we said, they just wanted to offer a quick response, that we would find that very off-putting. So I think in the same way that we would want them to listen to us and really understand their perspective or our perspective, so we should extend the same courtesy to them to really try to understand where they're coming from.
And at the end of that interview, he says, "The fact that I've argued against God's existence should not lead someone to believe that I am indifferent to God's existence or even hopeful that God does not exist. If you'll pardon the analogy, I am very, very confident that I am not a millionaire, but no one should conclude from that belief that I don't wish I were a millionaire or even that I am indifferent about becoming one. I wish theism were true for at least three reasons. One, the opportunity to live longer than the short amount of time I'll get on earth. Two, the guarantee of perfect justice. And three, the possibilities that would come from fellowship with God." You want to amplify on that in any way?
Well, I just think it shows someone who has really thought about it. So often, you know, the popular perception of atheists are of people who say, "I don't want to submit to God," or "I don't want there to be a God. I hope there's no God. If there were a God, he would be a tyrant." I hear those kinds of statements sometimes. So it's really helpful to have someone like Jeff think about it dispassionately and objectively and give the reasons why, yeah, it would be great if God existed, and still for him to conclude that he's not persuaded that God exists, but that he's open to it. I mean, I think that just says a lot for how the rebellion thesis doesn't accurately represent the way many atheists are, the way they think.
Yeah, you point out in your conclusion, while I've detected hostility in some atheists, it's by no means universal. On the whole, I haven't found atheists to be any angrier or more hostile than anybody else. Let's go to John. Good evening, you're on Amplify on KDKA. John.
Yes, I'm interested in approach to atheists and agnostics, because I consider myself a doubter and agnostic. I was brought up in the Catholic Church, and I am not at that point now. And I really feel that the real fanaticism often comes in the other direction, from Christians who are in many cases fundamentalist and really hate anybody who doesn't have these, anyone who has these doubts. And as you say, they probably do themselves. But I think that we have to realize that what matters is its effects. And I find so many of today's Christians supportive of wars that are killing millions of people by the United States around the world, that support the cutoff of any kind of help to poor people that have children but are forgotten by these anti-abortionists after they have a child, and want actually to cut off any kind of life support to them and social assistance programs before or after their actual birth. So I think we have to look at the effects. And I would, as you say, hope for a loving and a fair God, not a genocidal God that wipes out whole cities on the basis of some people there. Being palmed off as, well, this is a mystery. Well, no, we have to have some reasonable standards and not allow this to say that God supports these kinds of atrocities. And one of them I notice is the Christian Zionist. And I've been reading lately a pastor who has valiantly been trying to oppose this perversion of Christianity called Christian Zionism that is based on the fraudulent Scofield Bible that has probably infiltrated virtually all of the Bibles with the help of British and American intelligence to say that anything that Israel does in terms of its crimes against the Palestinians or wars around the world or supporting us to go even beyond our own warmongering against Iran and the rest of it, we must obey them. And it turns out that this was a fraudulent, concocted document by British intelligence and the Zionist movement that has now infiltrated all of the Bibles in the margins and in the footnotes. And this pastor by the name of Charles E. Carlson has produced a world-winning documentary called Christian Zionism, The Tragedy and the Turning. Christian Zionism, The Tragedy and the Turning. How scores of millions of Christians have been deluded by this into supporting totally un-Christian, if I may describe it as such, violations of the idea of loving thy neighbor.
Okay, John, let me just bring Randall in here for a second. Randall, any response at this point?
Yeah, there's certainly a lot there. I guess first thing, I'll make a specific response to the reference to Scofield Study Bible and then a general observation. Specifically, what Scofield's Bible did, it was published in 1909, and it popularized the teachings of a fellow who came from Ireland to North America, and he had developed a system called dispensationalism, which was a particular understanding of how to interpret the Bible that, among other things, it distinguished between Israel and the church, and it interpreted prophecies in the Old Testament for the restoration of Israel literally. And dispensationalism was popularized through Darby and then later on through the Scofield Reference Bible. And I teach history, so I don't think there's evidence for British intelligence or any strategy to popularize it. But it is popular in North America among many evangelicals, and it's represented in the Left Behind series. And often that kind of approach to Zionism does lead, as you pointed out, to a lot of injustices being visited upon the Palestinian people, where you simply have this unqualified support for the state of Israel and whatever they're doing. Now, as a general observation, I think, first of all, I'll just say maybe two things. One is that Christians disagree about that. So some are Zionists and some aren't. But as your caller notes, A lot of people have objections not to God per se, but to the way Christians are acting. When they find Christians behaving in a way inconsistent with their beliefs, then they rightly raise an objection to that. So we always need to consider, when we experience hostility in others, is that hostility directed toward God, or is it directed toward the way Christians are behaving?
John, any final thoughts?
Yes, I hope you will check out this Christian Zionism, The Tragedy and the Turning, because it does bring out that the Oxford Press was tied to British intelligence and the Zionist movement of the early 19th century, and it was expanded into the usefulness of having this kind of a justification for the formation of Israel and supporting any of its war incitements against the Palestinians and inciting the United States to even expand its own tendency towards wars.
Okay, John, thank you for that. We really want to move on to some other aspects of the book now. Thanks for calling.
Thanks.
Anything more that you want to talk about answer there?
Maybe I'll just return to the general point, because I think it is important to underscore whatever one thinks about various conspiracy theories. The message that Christians often are the source of hostility in other people, we can't lose sight of that, which is, I think, the main point. I give one example in the book of a woman named Emma Tom, who is an atheist, who recalls in an essay she wrote that when she was very young in school, the teacher said, everybody who's an atheist is going to get leprosy. And this teacher was Christian, and her parents were atheists. And that was her first introduction to Christianity, was a Christian saying, your parents are going to get leprosy. So it's no surprise, when you have experiences like that in people's past, that they end up with a lot of hostility towards the church.
In the fifth chapter, you um, t- titled What About the Atheists Who Say They Don't Want There to Be a God? You begin with the story of the 2012 presidential election. Tell us about that, since we're almost in that place right now.
Yeah, so I thought this was a helpful way to think about this issue. Back in the 2012 election campaign, Mitt Romney, in May of 2012, made a statement behind closed doors to a group of fundraisers saying, there are 47% of the people who will vote for the president, and that is for Obama, no matter what. And he said that they are people who are dependent on the state, on the government, so he's not going to worry about that 47%. And that quote was later on released in September of that year, and it went public, and it became known as the 47% quote. A lot of people took that quote to represent not only Romney's views in a particular moment, but a general attitude of Republicans toward the poor, that they tend to write the poor off. So they took a single quote and used that as a justification to sort of reject the whole Republican platform. And I think sometimes Christians approach atheists in the same way. They'll take a single quote that an atheist makes, such as Christopher Hitchens, a well-known atheist, passed away in 2011, but he was well-known for saying he's an anti-theist, that he's against God. And Christians will take a single sentence from him or a quote from people like Hitchens and say, that gives us a general perspective on atheists.
Mm-hmm. And the questions that you raise within this chapter, boy, I certainly want to get to the end of the book about the atheist as a neighbor. Can you really be angry at God, at a God that you don't believe in? Atheists who don't want there to be a God. And then, is it irrational to oppose God? Is there rational rebellion against God? Say just a little bit about those questions you raised. We just have a couple minutes before we take our next break.
So yeah, the one, sometimes atheists will say, well, it doesn't make any sense to think that an atheist could be hostile toward God, because you can't be hostile towards someone you believe doesn't exist. Now, I do offer a response to that, and I do say, well, it is possible to be against God's existence, to say, I hope there is no God. So in that kind of sense, I think people who are atheists can be hostile toward God or toward the idea of God. So that's a little bit of what I'm explaining there. And that's just a way of pointing out that, I mean, atheists can be hostile toward the idea of God, just like, you know, anybody else can. Now, the other question, is it rational to hope that God doesn't exist? And while I understand the emotional objection to God, if we have defined God appropriately as a maximally good, loving being, I don't think it makes sense to hope God doesn't exist. And that's why Jeff Lauder would agree with me that the atheist I interviewed, he would think it doesn't really make sense to hope God doesn't exist. Everybody should hope God exists. But too often, what atheists do is they'll turn toward a caricature of God. And sometimes, you know, it's the tyrant or something like that. Well, nobody wants a tyrant to exist, but if you define God appropriately, yes, we should hope God exists.
And you write that whenever I encounter rejection of religion as a sweeping, unqualified, I can't help but wonder whether that rejection might be fueled by a misunderstanding of some myths. We're going to take this break. When we come back, we will continue our discussion about The Atheist Is My Neighbor, Rethinking Christian Attitudes Toward Atheism, and that's with Professor Randall Rouser. Welcome back to the final segment of Amplified, just about 20 minutes, a little less than that, till 5 minutes before the hour. Our guest is Professor Randall Rouser. We're talking about his book, Is the Atheist My Neighbor? And that brings us to the final chapter, Professor, The Atheist as a Neighbor. And probably that's the real question for most of us. And you write, well, I readily concede that there is no shortage of abrasive, combative, and obnoxious theists or Christians. In my experience, there's also no shortage of abrasive, combative, and obnoxious atheists. And I don't see much value in attempting to establish that one of these two groups tends to be better behaved than the other. I'm not claiming atheists are on the whole any worse behaved than Christians, but I certainly don't see evidence that they're generally better either. Amplify for us.
Yeah, I think that, first of all, often within our society today, we tend to give an inordinate amount of attention to the loudest, brashest voices. So as an example, just look at the attention that Donald Trump continues to receive in the race for the Republican nomination, continually saying all sorts of extraordinary, very kind of harsh things about immigrant groups, about various other groups, about war veterans and so on. But those kinds of brash statements and brash personalities get the attention, and often it's the same thing. So we get, say with atheists, we'll focus on Richard Dawkins, who makes these very incendiary statements against Christians, or we'll focus on John Hagee, who says atheists are brain dead and should get out of the country. And what gets lost in the middle of all that are the soft, thoughtful, reflective voices on both sides. So I think what we need to do is really make an effort to turn down the volume on some of the brasher, more aggressive voices and elevate the quieter, more thoughtful, more generous people on both sides, people who are not wanting to shut out the other side with simple labels and categories, who do want to have conversation, who are willing to extend hospitality to the others, playing the game of, well, who's better, which community is smarter, which community is more rational or generous or whatever, I think is just a waste of time. I think what we need to do is simply start loving our neighbor, and that includes the atheist.
Would it help us to understand why do we focus on such voices?
Yes, and I think probably it's interesting, it's entertaining. That's one thing. I mean, the reality is I do read a lot of articles about Donald Trump, probably more than I should, because he's interesting. But we need to kind of wean ourselves off of what is sometimes sort of junk food for the mind, constantly just focusing on the loudest, brashest voices. I think another issue, perhaps a deeper one, is that people are sometimes threatened by others, by those who are different from them. And to identify with the loud, brasher voices is a comforting thing for those people because it reestablishes the order of the world. It lets us know that we're really the smarter group. We're really the better group. I know that I'm in the right group. But that is a kind of comfort that I think is bought at the cost of appreciating the deep complexity in the world. No, not all atheists are fools. And if that is unsettling to us, if it's unsettling to realize that some people can disbelieve in God's existence and still be reasonable, thoughtful, kind people, I think we just need to come to terms with that. And we can't allow ourselves to maintain the comfort levels simply by perpetuating something like the rebellion thesis.
And Jesus must have been teaching us something when he said that it's easy to love those who love us. What the challenge is sometimes is to love even those who we believe to be our enemies.
Yes, and very much so. It's the amazing thing is how quickly a kind hand, or as I said earlier, an open hand rather than a closed fist, how quickly that can de-escalate a situation, even to something as trivial as being in traffic. You know, you cut somebody off inadvertently. They lay on their horn. That's their first reaction. Your first reaction then is to shake your hand, your fist back at them angrily, and now the situation escalates. But if they honk on their horn and we turn around and our first reaction is to say, I'm sorry, I didn't see you, it's very hard for them to continue to be angry with that kind of response. And if we just carry that into our interactions with people on a daily basis, I think we'll find that we're finding a lot more agreement and common ground than we initially thought we would.
And you write in your book at this point, I think we have enough data to justify the conclusion that some Christians are nice to atheists and some atheists are nice to Christians. So what say we all make an effort to be nicer? And you write, fair enough, except for one thing. I think Christians need to take ownership of the degree to which their own widespread and centuries-old prejudices towards atheists might have precipitated, or at least spurred on, this whole laminable cycle of escalating hostilities. At this point, we can make an appeal to Newton's third law. For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. Given the fact that Christians have long marginalized atheists by tarring them with the brush of the rebellion thesis, is it any surprise that many atheists have responded in kind? So where do we go from here then?
Yeah, I think there's a couple points that I'd like to highlight there. The first one is the one that I also referred to earlier, that some of the hostility that we experience from atheists is a result of, let's say, alienation from the church or from a history of Christians marginalizing them in a way like that described by the rebellion thesis. So the first thing we have to remember if we encounter that kind of hostility is we sort of have to take the blame, some of the responsibility for being the progenitors of this kind of hostility, that we created the space in which people would be hostile. Again, this is blowback. It's like if you invade another country and people are angry and respond angrily at your soldiers as they invade the country, well, that's blowback, and Christians have often expressed that kind of hostility toward atheists. But even beyond that, my second point is, rather than worry about, well, who hurt who first, we as Christians have simply a call from Jesus himself to love other people, love, as you said, our enemies, pray for those who persecute us, who show hostility toward us, who insult us, who call us faith heads, who call us irrational. We are called to extend to them nothing but love, nothing but that open hand, not anger, not a label like you are a fool, April 1st is Atheist Day because that's April Fool's Day. That is, all of that kind of behavior is beneath the Christian and what Christ has called us to.
We must rediscover true hospitality, and you use the example of Henry Nouwen. Tell us a little bit about the story of his Zen master.
Yeah, that's a story that I've had a big impact on me. So he describes a Zen master who, there's a man that comes, wants to learn from him, and the master, there's a full cup of tea, and he starts pouring more tea into it, and it starts overflowing. And the man says, you know, it's overflowing, you've got to stop. So then the master reflects, well, just as the teacup is already full and can take no more tea, so you, as a student, you're already full of your own ideas, of your own assumptions. You're not ready to learn from me yet. What you've got to do is empty your cup, and then you can begin to learn from me as a teacher. And I think that is a fitting metaphor for hospitality in these kinds of interactions. We need to set aside the assumptions of atheists as being hostile toward God, as them being angry at God. We need to bring an empty cup in our interactions with atheists as well as with anyone else and simply hear from them what their views are and why they hold their views. And when we do that, I think, again, we will be surprised and we will come to a much deeper understanding of where people are coming from.
And so as we try to empty our cups of misconceptions, what would you say to atheists and what would you say to Christians?
Well, I would say, again, that this conversation does go both ways. So I think both sides, we need to strive to set aside some of our assumptions. A few years ago, I met Nate Phelps. Now, Nate Phelps is the son of Fred Phelps. And Fred Phelps was the head pastor of Westboro Baptist Church, which is this infamous church in the Midwest in Kansas that they're known for picketing funerals of dead soldiers and for saying God hates fags. That's their language, right? They have a website devoted to how God hates homosexual people and pretty much everybody else except the people in their community. Nate grew up in his father's church. And so the presentation he got of Christianity was of this hate-filled group. And I can understand why somebody like Nate would have some sort of reservations about Christians. The challenge for him, and again for all of us, is to say whatever our background experiences, I can't allow those to prevent me from learning what this person has to say to me, what their experiences are. Because not every Christian, thank goodness, is Fred Phelps. But not every atheist is Richard Dawkins or Christopher Hitchens. Not every atheist is expressing hostility toward God or Christians. And so we need to learn where people are coming from and why they take that position.
And so when you're addressing atheists, we've talked about Christians and what they need to do. Atheists may assume that Christians are fanatics or that they're fearful of life without God or that they're especially irrational and credulous. The first thing I would suggest is that if atheists really want to understand Christians and all their diversity, and indeed we are diverse, I would suggest that they empty their cups and make an effort to get to know some Christians from diverse cultural, ecclesial, and socioeconomic backgrounds, and then seek to understand what they believe and why. To those atheists, I say, please don't summarily judge and dismiss all Christians based on your experience of Christianity, no matter how bad it may have been. If the only Christians you've met preach six-day creationism and deny global warming, for example, then you need to meet more Christians.
Yes, so let's take the caller earlier. Now, he was giving examples of Christians supporting something like the invasion of Iraq or an unqualified support for the state of Israel. But there are also Christians, for example, who loudly opposed the invasion of Iraq. There are Christians who work with Christian peacemaker teams in the occupied territories with Palestinians fighting for social justice for Palestinians. So we always need to be careful, whether we're Christian, atheist, or anyone else, about generalizing about an entire community based upon our limited experience. And that does happen a lot when there are atheists, let's say, that grew up in a particular church and had a bad experience. But you have to be very careful. If you're talking about a community of more than 2 billion people, we can't generalize. We have to be very careful. The same, of course, is true for Christians. We can't judge all atheists by some past experiences.
And in your book, we've already mentioned Pope Francis, but tell us about your favorite Francis moment. And the one most relevant to the current discussion came in 2013 when you said he raised eyebrows around the world with his Wednesday morning homily of May 22nd.
Yeah, so that's when he made this very provocative statement. He said, "The Lord has redeemed all of us with the blood of Christ, not just Catholics," he said, "everyone." And then he presents someone saying, "Father, the atheists? Even the atheists. Everyone." And then he says, "We must meet one another doing good. But I don't believe. Father, I am an atheist. But do good. We will meet one another there." What I love about that statement, it reminds me in a sense of the man who says to Jesus in Mark, "Lord, I believe, help my unbelief." Rather than focus on belief, he focuses, he says, do good. Because as you do good, as you love other people, whether you're a Christian or an atheist, you begin to embody the works of the kingdom. And so rather than try to tell people to believe something they don't yet believe, Pope Francis extends an open hand by saying, "Join us in the works of the kingdom and begin to be transformed by loving others as I've called others, or as Christ has called others to love." And I think that is a much more powerful way to respond to atheism, to invite them to join into the works of the kingdom rather than to say, "Well, you're in rebellion against God." Essentially, Pope Francis is inviting them to become a part of the church without even recognizing it. And then someday, by the power of God and his Spirit, people can find themselves in relationship with him. It just seems to me a much more inviting way to think about dealing with doubt.
And certainly a lot of people were angry with Francis, and people might be angry with the positions we're taking this evening also. But you're right, to be honest, I don't see that Pope Francis was being any more radical than Jesus was 2 millennia ago when he placed a Samaritan at the center of his parable of kingdom work. Of course, being no more radical than Jesus isn't too bad, given that Jesus turned the world upside down. And so where we began the program, we begin to close it, don't we?
Yeah, it's sort of bookended in a sense. Again, and it just challenges us to recognize when Jesus shows somebody living out in a way honoring to God, he takes the people that are in the out group. He takes the Samaritan. And for us to begin to do the same is to take the atheist. So I think it is a beautiful challenge for us as Christians to reinvent what hospitality means to this often marginalized and distrusted community.
And the reaction to the Vatican to the criticism was that the Pope is very pleased for having met a simple man, and that the point also made that they share a beautiful commitment to humble, simple living. And don't we, me as a Catholic, you as a Protestant, also need to be able to enter into discussions the same way about the differences between us?
Every day we encounter people that are fundamentally different than us. You know, my daughter's 13 right now. Her first best friend was Sikh. Her second best friend was Buddhist. Her third best friend was an atheist. We live in a pluralistic world, and we simply cannot continue to perpetuate these assumptions that marginalize different groups. We need to come to learn where people are coming from, and that's the way that not only we will change them, but we will be changed by them.
Our guest this evening has been Professor Randall Rausser. We've been talking about his book, Is the Atheist My Neighbor? Rethinking Christian Attitudes Towards Atheism. I hope with the professor's book we've helped to do that for you, if that's the way you're thinking. Professor, thank you very much for being with us once again.
Father Ron, thank you so much. It's been a delight.
All right. Good night.